Israel left Egypt and wandered in the wilderness for 40 years, they finally stood on the threshold of the land of Canaan. Now, the land of Canaan is called the land of promise or the promised land, but in the eyes of God, the land was already theirs. God had said that wherever the soles of their feet trod, the land belonged to the Hebrews. In a sense, it wasn't really a land to be fought for at all, because the land had already been given to the Hebrews. It was simply a question of going in and claiming what God had given them. So you see, the land of promise to God was a very definite thing. But for the Hebrews, it always remained a land of promise. And the nearest they came to possessing their heritage was in the days of Solomon, whose kingdom stretched almost from Egypt in the south, almost to the rivers Tigris and Euphrates in the east and in the northeast. And that was the nearest God's people came to possessing their heritage. After the death of Solomon, of course, the kingdom fell to pieces. The tribes split up, 10 tribes going to the north and becoming Israel, 2 tribes remaining in the south and calling themselves Judah, with the capital at Jerusalem. But the Jews never really possessed the land, and it always remained for them a land of promise, something always in front of them, and never really something under their feet, their actual possession. And they stood on the borders of this land and they looked in. Now, they shouldn't have stopped, of course. They should just have gone right in. But they stopped. And they weren't sure of the future, and they weren't very sure of God's promise, and they rather doubted what God had said to them. So they decided to try and do things their way, and they sent in spies. Now, that wasn't a good thing, really, because it was a lack of faith. They should have believed God, but they wouldn't believe God. They wanted to do it their way. It's always our own way that ruins us. Always. If you want to ruin your life, have your own way. If you want to make a mess of your life, just have things your own way. You'll make a mess. So they didn't trust God. And they sent in the spies, and half of the spies came back with very bad news. And they said, oh, you can't go in there. The place is crawling with giants. And they're like grasshoppers. There are so many. They're all over the land. And these giants live in cities with stone walls, the likes of which had never been heard of. They'd never seen stone walls since they'd left Egypt, because they'd lived in tents for 40 years, animal skins, impermanent, a pilgrim people, always on the move. And when they heard of this, you see, stone walls and giants, they said, well, best thing we can do is turn back and go home to Egypt. Now, all the spies said that, with the exception of 2 men. The 2 men, of course, were Joshua and Caleb. And these were the only 2 men who came out of Egypt and went into the land. Everybody else died. Everyone, including Moses. Moses didn't see the land, but he saw it from Mount Nebo, Mount Pisgah. Was buried by God there, but he was buried by God on the wrong side of the river. It was almost always the land of promise. Something on the horizon. Something you never really possessed. And so Joshua and Caleb, because they were the 2 spies who came back with good news. The grapes of Eshcol, you remember. And they said, if you don't believe us, you can taste them now because we've brought them back with us. You can have the fruit of the land now before you go in. These two men said, go in and possess the land. There's nothing to be afraid of. God's on your side. And these two men were allowed in, and all the rest died. Now, why am I speaking about giants? Well, you see, the children of Israel did not deal with these giants. That was their tragedy. It was the Ammonites who killed these giants. There's a very important verse which we'll look at in a wee while, which shows that it was to the shame of God's people that they did not deal with these monsters, these dragons stalking about the land. It was left to God's enemies to deal with the giants. It's almost, my friends, as if the British Humanist Association were to clean up the morals of Britain to the shame of the Christian Church. It is almost as if the British Rationalist Press, which is an atheist organization and committed to the promulgation of atheism and atheistic views, it's almost as if the British Humanist press, the rationalist press, were to buy up the Scottish Daily News and produce a decent newspaper to the shame of the Christians. God's people didn't slay the giants. It was God's enemies who slew the giants to the shame of God's people. Now, here's the message tonight. Saul, anointed by God, slays the slayer of giants. Now my question is, what does it take to become a slayer of the slayer of giants? If you are going to deal with the giants and the monsters in your own life, in your own personality, and all the things that make you go wrong and put you off the rails as a Christian, I'm speaking of the giants inside you, the monsters that stalk inside your personality, things that are out of control. There are Christians here and there are things out of control in their lives. You can't handle them. They're monsters. And they are stalking the land like grasshoppers inside you, and they are out of control. How do you become a Christian? What does it take to be a Christian who slays the slayers of giants? Now that's it. So I want to speak tonight, first of all, about these giants, because they're very interesting. And then look at Saul. And in the very best Christian light, because of course it's a great question as to whether Saul was really a regenerate man, whether he was twice born or not, but with our best Christian understanding, I want to look at this man and see how God used him and what God gave him to make him a slayer of the slayer of giants. Now, that's the sermon, and you can switch off now if you like, but if you care to see the story, the giants first appear in Genesis chapter 6. Now, I won't do all the references, because there are hundreds of them, but first of all, they come on the scene in Genesis chapter 6, just before the flood. I know there are different interpretations to this passage, but I'll give you my interpretation. I can't give you them all, and I can't believe them all, since they are mutually self-contradictory. but you've got to make up your mind which one you think is true. So I'll tell you which one I think is true. And I think what I believe is supported by the New Testament. By the way, before we read this, the giants are called by different names. And if you're using the RSV, you'll find that they are called by their proper names. Now, in the Authorized Version, they're simply called giants all the way through, but they've got different names. Sometimes they're called the Nephilim. Sometimes they're called the Zumim. Sometimes they're called the Zamzumim. Sometimes they're called the Enim. And sometimes called the Rephaim. But they all seem to be a clan of giants, a tribe of their own. Big, hulking fellows, rather brutish, and, if truth be told, really demonized men, because they come from a demonic origin. So there are the names Nephilim, Zumim, Emim, Zamzumim, and the Rephaim, and we'll meet them now. When men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were fair. Now, the sons of God in the Bible is an expression that sometimes refers not to men, but to angels. And I think that the sons of God here are fallen angels, demons, demonic spirits. Now, you say, that's fantastic. Where now? How can you get angels marrying men? Well, you see, demonic spirits can do a lot of interesting things. They can take shapes. They can appear. And in the New Testament, in fact, when Peter speaks about the spirits in prison, angelic spirits bound by God for their wickedness, Peter associates their binding with the flood, who were disobedient at the time of the flood. Now, Genesis chapter 6, you see, is the prelude to the flood. So that's the link, you see. When men began to multiply on the face of the ground, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God, demonized beings, saw that the daughters of men were fair, and they took to wife such of them as they chose. If you take this at its most general, it is a demonization of humanity. It is an eruption of spirits from the pit, invading men and demonizing the world, such as we have in our own generation. Then the Lord said, being very grieved, "My spirit shall not always abide in man forever, for he is flesh, but his days shall be 120 years. It's come down a lot since then, you see. 80 years and 10 keeps coming down as the centuries move along. His day shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days. Now, you see, I think that these Nephilim, these giants, were the monstrous progeny, the monstrous produce of these lawless marriages. These lawless marriages that were a fusion of two alien natures, spirit nature and flesh nature, demons and men, against the law of God. It's called confusion in the Bible, that kind of union, that kind of marriage. And so the progeny are monsters, Nephilim. Verse 4, the Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterwards, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, they bore children to them. These were mighty men of old. You notice that they're not men of grace and loving kindness, but they're fighters. They're interested in war and in killing people. And this is what has come to the earth in this eruption of demons from the pit, a demonized humanity. Who said the Bible's out of date? It's the most contemporary book in the world, this. Wars and rumors of war. Demonic. These were the mighty men of old. the men of renown. And the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. So that's the first intimation, and it's not a happy one. Now, if you turn to Genesis 14 and verse 5, quickly, the famous battle in the valley of the Dead Sea involving Abraham and this great king Chedorlaomer. In chapter 14 and verse 5, you'll see that a lot of the giants were involved there. Verse 5, in the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him came and subdued the Rephaim, there they are, in Ashtaroth-Karnaim, the Zuzim, there they are again, another family of the clan in Ham, the Emim, there's another group in Shaveh Kiriathaim, and the Horites, who were just ordinary men, in Mount Seir as far as El Paran. Now don't be dismayed by these long, awful Hebrew words. Pick out the giants there in verse 5. Rephaim, Zumim, and Emim, and they're still in the land in the days of Abraham. If you look into the next chapter, chapter 15, and verse 20, well, really, verse 18. On that day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I give this land. I give this land. Underline it. I give this land. From the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates. And these were the bounds of Solomon's kingdom. The land of the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Rephaim. So they're still in the land. The Amorites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, and the Jebusites. Turning to the book of Numbers. Now these are all in the right order, I think. Numbers chapter 13. You see, I'm working up to Goliath. See, he was a giant. Now the interesting thing is, you see, he wasn't challenging David. He was challenging David's God, a demonized man. Numbers 13 and verse 30. But Caleb, one of the good spies, quieted the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it. Then the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we. So they brought to the people of Israel an evil report of the land which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone to spy it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people that we saw in it are men of great stature. You see, bad news, frightening to the Christians, giants. And there we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, who come from the Nephilim, you see, interrelated giants, and we seemed to ourselves like grasshoppers compared to them, and so we seemed to them. In Deuteronomy, if you like to pronounce it that way, chapter 2, and verse 20. Well, beg your pardon, verse 11 first. Sorry, verse 10. Sorry. The Emim, there they are again, you see, still alive, formerly lived there, a people great and many, and tall as the Anakim.
Like the Anakim, they are also known as Rephaim, but the Moabites call them Emim. You see that? It's as if an Englishman came up to sea in Inverness at the start of the 18th century. The clansmen in those days were very primitive. See, they didn't dress at all like today. If you see some of the old etchings of clansmen in those days, they didn't wear smart kilts with sporrans and all the rest of it. It's just a great big blanket thrown round you as best you could. Now, you see, English people coming up to Inverness in those days would be terrified by some of the clansmen coming down to Inverness to do their shopping, because Inverness was a very primitive place in those days. If you've read the recent Inverness Field Club book, very, no drains, and I think three streets, all full of mud, only one or two stone houses, the rest of the people living in houses made of peat and turf, and with turf roofs, very, very primitive, and these wild creatures coming down from Tongue and Sutherland, you see, must have looked terrible to them. My people were Highland, I know what I'm speaking about, they were all Fergusons and guns from the north, wild, wild people, you see. And so the Israelites, looking at these giants, would say, mercy, what kind of a clan is this? What kind of relatives do they have here? These big, surly, graceless, demonized chaps stalking through the land. And they were afraid. Like Christians today, they're afraid of the giants in the land. Deuteronomy 2 and 10. The Emim formerly lived there, a people great and many, and tall as the Anakim. Like the Anakim, they are also known as Rephaim, but the Moabites call them Emim. Now, if you look down to verse 20, here they are again. That also is known as a land of Rephaim. Rephaim formerly lived there, but the Ammonites, whom Saul killed tonight, call them Zamzumim, a people great and many and tall as the Anakim, but the Lord destroyed them before them. That's the Ammonites. The Lord destroyed them before the Ammonites. The Ammonites beat them, and they dispossessed them and settled in their stead. So that the land of Ammon used to be inhabited by giants, but God's enemies, the Ammonites, subdued them. If you look into chapter 3, not to weary you, chapter 3 and verse 11, a famous verse, there was a man called Og, the king of Bashan, and he was related to these giants, and since he was a giant, he needed a bed, a very big bed. You're tall, trying to sleep in a small bed. It's not very comfortable. You go to a hotel and you don't get a long enough bed. So Og had a huge bed. And after he had died, it was kept as a kind of museum piece. And people came to see this vast bed that this big man used to sleep on. Chapter 3 and verse 11. For only Og, the king of Bashan, was left of the remnant of the Rephaim, the giants. Behold his bedstead, who was a bedstead of iron. Is it not in Rabbah of the Ammonites? Haven't they kept it as a kind of spectacle? This vast bed. 9 cubits was its length. Well, you can measure it. A cubit is your elbow to the point of your finger. So 9 times that would be 18 feet long. No complaints there, I don't think. A bed 18 feet long and 4 cubits in breadth. 4 to 8 feet broad. No complaints there. A bed for a giant, according to the common cubit. Verse 13, not to weary you. The rest of Gilead and all Bashan, the kingdom of Og, that is, all the region of Argob, I gave to the half tribe of Manasseh. The whole of that Bashan is called the land of Rephaim. There were so many giants. It was called Giant's Country, the land of Rephaim. 2 Samuel, it's the last of these references, 2 Samuel 21. You see, Goliath comes into this, for he was one of the giants. Some awful names here. I hope I can say them. 2 Samuel 21. Found it? And if you follow this carefully, you'll discover David's other name. Did you know that David had another name? David wasn't his first name, proper name. 2 Samuel 21 and 15. The Philistines had war again with Israel, and David went down together with his servants. They fought against the Philistines, and David grew weary. And Ish-bi-benob, one of the descendants of the giants. So they're still in the land in the days of David. Whose spear weighed 300 shekels of bronze. And who was girded with a new sword, thought to kill David, this monster. See, the devil's in it all the time. It started in Genesis 6 with something demonic. And all the way through, it's the devil against God. It's not Israel against the enemies. It's the devil against God. That's a struggle. It's a battle in the heavenlies. It's war in heaven. Revelation. That's what it is. That's where the real fighting takes place. 16. And Ish-bi-benob, one of the descendants of the giants, whose spear weighed 300 shekels of bronze, and who was girded with a new sword, thought to kill David. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, came to his aid and attacked the Philistine and killed him. Then David's men adjured him, "You shall no more go out with us to battle, lest you quench the lamp of Israel, lest you get killed." And after this, there was again war with the Philistines at Gob. Then Sibbecai the Hushathite slew Saph, who was one of the descendants of the giants. So they're still there. And there was again war with the Philistines at Gob. And Elhanan, and that's David, the son of, oh mercy, I prefer his other name, which is Jesse. See, they had two names. Jesse, the son of David. And here's this man, Jaareor Egim, who's the father of Elhanan. And that's David's other name. The Bethlehemite, you see, because they came from Bethlehem, slew Goliath the Gittite. He's a giant, you see. The shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. And there was war again at Gath, where there was a man of great stature who had six fingers on each hand. You see the freaks, oddities, Genesis 6, monsters. Six fingers on each hand and six toes in each foot, 24 in number, in case you can't count. And he also was descended from the giants. So there's a whole progeny of them, a generation. And when he taunted Israel, Jonathan, the son of Shimei, David's brother, slew him. These four men were descended from the giants in Gath, and they fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. No. These giants were slain by the Ammonites, and the Ammonites were slain by Saul. So what does it take to be a slayer of the slayer of giants? What would it take you as a Christian to be a slayer of some of the giants in Scotland today, in the world, demonized humanity? What would it take you?
Well, I will tell you. You see, God took Saul to four places before this battle. You read it in last week's chapter. You can read it for yourself later on this evening in the privacy of your home, because we don't have time to read it now. God took him to four places, and God was saying to him, Saul, my fellow, if you want to fight for me, you must learn four lessons. The first place was the grave of Rachel, who died in childbirth having Benjamin. Now, why did Rachel die? Because she was greedy for power. She already had a son called Joseph. And Joseph means, may the Lord add. At first she was childless, and she didn't like being childless because the other wife was having all the babies. And she got angry, and she cried to God for a child. And God gave her this boy, and she called the boy Joseph, which means, may the Lord add. And she wanted more babies to be one up on the other wife. She wanted power over this other woman. And God said, all right, my dear, I will give you the power if you pay the price. And she got the power, which was another son, Benjamin, son of her father's right hand. But she died, because the first lesson is that in the spiritual life, the price of power is death. If you want power, you've got to die. That's true for Christians. That's the message of Romans 6. If you want to be something or somebody for Jesus Christ, you must die. There's a whole world of things you've got to die to. Some people have to die to their religion before they can be of any use to Christ. You've certainly got to die to your sin. Some people have to die to their shyness and their timidity, because often, you know, there are Christians in whom shyness and timidity are just an affectation. They're just an excuse for hiding from spiritual reality and the challenge of the gospel. Too many mousy Christians who are using their shyness and their modesty and their timidity as an excuse for running away from Jesus Christ. If you want power, you have to die. That's the message of Rachel's tomb. And then God took Saul to Bethel. What's the message of Bethel? Well, you remember somebody once fell asleep there. It was Jacob. And he saw a ladder between heaven and earth. And he saw angels coming down and up, down and up, down first. He didn't see a ladder and a voice saying, you come up here, Jacob. Come on, start climbing. Try a bit harder and you'll get up. Not that at all. It's a message of grace. That's the dream at Bethel. There's a ladder between heaven and earth, and the grace comes down the ladder. God doesn't ask you to come up and scale the battlements of glory in order to find grace. Grace comes down to you. First of all, God gives you something. That's Bethel. And then God took him to Gibeah, where Saul received the blessing of the Spirit, the fullness of the Spirit, amongst those Pentecostal prophets, these ecstatic, charismatic prophets, dancing in the street. They were so full of joy. Fullness. That's what he got at Gibeah. Colossians chapter 1 and 2. That the fullness of the Godhead lives in Christ bodily,
And the fullness of Christ lives in a Christian. Fullness. And then God took him to the fourth place, which is Gilgal, and which is the Hebrew for rolling away. And it was called Gilgal because when the Hebrews crossed the river Jordan, Joshua discovered that many of them hadn't covenanted their children to Jehovah. The children hadn't been circumcised. And so the children were all circumcised there and consecrated to Jehovah. And the reproach of Israel was rolled away. Galgal. Gilgal. Rolling away. And Gilgal for Saul and Gilgal for a Christian speaks of the deep, deep cleansing that there needs to be in a person's life before he can be used by God. Here are the four places, and I invite you to come to them this evening in the closing minutes of this service. Christian, if your life is useless for Christ, if you have nothing to show for Jesus Christ, if your life is aimless and fruitless for Jesus Christ, listen. Rachel's grave. Do you want power? You must die. Bethel. Do you want grace? There is a ladder between heaven and earth, and the grace comes down. Gibeah, where the prophets are and where the Spirit was, the fullness of God. Gilgal, a rolling away of the past, and a deep, deep cleansing. I do not think that anything less than these four can challenge the giants in the church today, and in Scotland today, and in the world today. Humanity is being demonized before our very eyes. You can see it on television. Ulster, that's a demonic situation now. Maybe it's exorcism we should try. Maybe we should be casting out evil spirits. Those who have the gift to do it. Men and women are being demonized by the powers of hell, as they were in Genesis 6. And nothing less than these four things: power at the cost of death, grace coming down the ladder, the fullness at Gibeah, and the deep, deep cleansing, the rolling away of one's past at Gilgal. Nothing less than these will challenge the giants. You want to be a slayer of the slayer of giants? You want to be one more than the people who can kill giants? Well, this is the price. Are you prepared to pay it? It's expensive. It's very expensive. But what a challenge. Don't you think so? Amen. God will bless His word.